I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak with you today, and also to listen to these very interesting presentations with respect to the advances that are being made in the area of genome editing and its application to crops and crop improvement. Now, I'm a generalist, and so what I'm going to be speaking to you about today is my perspectives on safety, security, and policy as it relates to how regulatory authorities and the public at large are willing to accept and allow this type of technology to move forward. We see a wave of innovation coming at us in terms of what we can do with genome editing for crop improvement, but whether or not we're going to realize the opportunities there is going to depend on public acceptance as well as the regulatory frameworks that we have to deal with. So genome editing has rapidly emerged as a leading technology, and as we have heard today, we can go back to last century to see when genome editing was essentially developed as proofs of concept in crop plants. In 2004, we see the first regulatory inquiries taking place with regard to whether or not these types of concepts are going to be regulated under statutes existing here in the United States and elsewhere. So we have a fairly long history of working with these and a good deal of experience. But it's the advent of CRISPR-Cas9 and its application to crop plants beginning around 2013 that really heightened public interest, also heightened interest in the user community. This is a democratic process, one that we can approach in many laboratories as long as there's the ability to do the molecular biology and the transformations of plants. And we see multiple applications to date. I've only listed a few of them because I can't keep up with them. We've already heard about sugarcane today. Citrus was mentioned in an article last week as being a new target for editing with CRISPR-Cas9. So this ability to precisely edit affords significant opportunities for both the discovery of gene function and therefore fundamental research, as well as for the identification and development of useful crop traits. But in order to do that, we have to, as researchers and developers, address initial questions as to whether or not there are regulatory hurdles that we need to overcome in order to move forward. So whether or not we're doing fundamental research or doing research that's intended to move things into the marketplace, we have questions on permitting, biosafety regulation, and governance that need to be addressed and which are not totally clear in terms of genome-edited crops. The way we understand what can be done with these crops here in the United States is facilitated fairly well through our regulated letters of inquiry process. And I'm showing you an example here coming from work done by Bing Yang and his co-workers at the University of Tennessee within our Crop Bioengineering Center, who used talons to genome edit rice for disease resistance, and then as a post-editing procedure, segregated out the rDNA elements so that the product they're working with is transgene free. And they inquired of USDA as to whether or not this was relevant to regulatory oversight, and the answer was no. So that means that in a case like this, the product can go to other laboratories, it can be freely moved between laboratories for investigation without permitting. It also can go into the field without any further regulatory oversight. We saw in 2016 the first CRISPR-edited crops move through this same type of process within USDA through regulated letters of inquiry. And I'm showing you here some of the press that came out at the time. And it's interesting for a variety of perspectives. So we're looking here at articles in the Business Insider for the Pioneer Waxy Corn and in Nature for the University of Pennsylvania Non-Browning Mushroom. If you look first of all at the Business Insider presentation, that picture is not corn as we know it. And so if the individuals that are writing and communicating to the public their understanding of this new technology can't get the species right, I'm very concerned that they're getting the science right behind the bioengineering that's being involved. Also, you see that the editors are implying GMO in the headline. And whenever we start to associate GMOs genome editing, we're running into problems with regard to regulatory questions and as well as public acceptance. Similarly, we see in the Nature article this idea of escaping regulation. So this has been very good news for those of us that work in the area of molecular breeding and wish to use this as a technique to improve crops for the betterment of mankind. However, this good news for biotechnology, and here I'm showing headlines that came out of science publications at the same time, again relating to the non-browning mushroom. They come from the Royal Society of Chemistry, Biotech in Asia, and Nature. And if you see, this is this really excitement here. But what is this excitement? Is it excitement, or is it a reason for public concern? Here we're stating in the science literature the enthusiasm of scientists for dodging, bypassing, and escaping regulation. If that's the best message we have as plant breeders to carry forward with this technology, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We need to be talking about the benefits and why these benefits are important, why this particular technology is more specific than other technologies, and we do not need to be belaboring our excitement that we're not going to be in the same can of worms as we have for transgenics, because this kind of language will put us in that place. So there's a lot of public communication with regard to genome-edited crops, and I'm just giving you some examples that I encounter in my outreach presentations on this subject. Both scientists and the general public often ask this question, isn't this just another GMO? Well, in the public mind, GMO, many in the public don't even know what that is, but most of them will say, well, I don't think it's something I like. I'm concerned about it. And in regulatory situations in much of the world, Europe and elsewhere, GMO has a very specific regulatory definition that relates to recombinant DNA techniques being used in crop development. Therefore, if we're associating genome-edited crops with GMOs, we got this problem right away. I've been working with social scientists that are interested in the implications of genome-edited crops being found in the derived foods then that are in the marketplace and doing research in this area. And they're very insistent on talking about genome-editing foods. And the perception they have is that if you used genome-editing procedures to modify a crop, then that there's this idea that the derived food products have the opportunity to edit human genomes. Now, this may sound just ludicrous to those of us in a scientific audience, but we must understand these are the types of things that even well-educated public gets in mind when they look at these types of technologies. We've already heard the concern in an earlier presentation about the bleed over from human genome editing and all of the concerns about that, particularly the ethical concerns with regard to germline editing. And those issues bleed right over into crop genome editing. Even though they are not necessarily relevant scientific issues for us to take up because of the special nature of crop systems and the way that we breed and deploy crops, the questions are still going to be there in the public mind. And then finally, this idea that regulators have not considered the safety of these crops. This, of course, is not true. There is well over a decade of consideration of both the process and product-specific considerations for genome-edited crops by regulators here in the United States and through other parts of the world. And so this public confusion is something that we need to be quite concerned about. And addressing the confusion is complicated. That's really one of the problems we face, because genome editing entails a variety of reagent systems, a continuum of approaches that extend from point mutations, which can really not be differentiated from a natural spontaneous mutation in a plant, all the way through transgene insertions at safe harbor locations within the genome. In one instance, we have something that's definitely not anything different than something derived from nature, and in the other, we have something that obviously involves recombinant DNA. So there's no one answer to what the regulatory status of genome-edited crops may be. And so the regulated significance of genome editing with engineered nucleases depends both on the approach used and the type of edit that's being obtained. And so I'm showing you here a grid where what we see in green would be transient edits using, for example, ribonucleoprotein introduction, or edits where we encode the DNA that for the editing system, but subsequently use segregation to remove that prior to the plant materials moving forward in the plant breeding process. In both of those cases, if you're only talking about simple insertion deletions or some familiar trait insertions, as we saw for the HD example in an earlier presentation, these are probably not going to be of high interest to regulators, especially here in the United States, but it looks like in Europe as well, this may be something that is not going to be germane to their regulatory system. However, all of these other types of approaches and outcomes are clearly involving recombinant DNA, and so really are no different than transgenics. So here in the United States, we're lucky. We have precedents. I gave you three examples of precedents earlier, and because of those precedents, we have a fairly clear roadmap if we're scientists or developers that would like to go forward with these genome editing concepts for crop development. If the phenotype that's derived does not contain foreign DNA, then it's probably not going to be subject to regulation, at least as our regulations currently stand. Whereas if the phenotype is going to contain foreign DNA, either purposely or inadvertently, then it's going to be subject to regulation. So we're in a process of undertaking a thorough revision of the coordinated framework for biotechnology here in the United States. This is the framework that governs our regulatory decisions with regard to bioengineered organisms. And what we're seeing is some changes that may have ramifications for how genome editing is handled. I'm showing you here the Federal Register announcement for rulemaking that's underway within USDA APHIS. They've been very active in this area over the last 2 years. And in this regard, they're trying to shift away from what they've traditionally called genetically engineered organisms to products of biotechnology. These products of biotechnology are not products, they're actually processes that are being defined. They're defining very specific processes that are going to be subject to regulatory overview. And I've highlighted for you, techniques include deleting specific segments of the genome, adding segments to the genome, directed altering of the genome. Sounds like genome editing to me. And so we need to be concerned how this is going to play out. I actually think that APHIS has an approach in mind that's very similar but more formal than what they've done with regulated letters of inquiry, which would not be a true regulatory burden. But when we start regulating based on process, we're going to have problems down the road. And here's an example of why we have problems. There's a conundrum, the same outcome with different processes. So I grabbed an example out of the literature. A common breeding target in recent years has been to develop low phytate maize by modifications of the phytic acid pathway. And I'm showing you here examples from the literature where this has been attempted using traditional selective plant breeding, selective plant breeding using a mutagenic agent in combination, using transgenic techniques, and using genome engineering with genome editing with engineered nucleases. In all cases, the phenotype being derived are essentially the same, but the regulatory questions that are asked for these products are all different. And it's interesting that we're moving in our science away from traditional breeding techniques towards molecular breeding techniques that are more highly specific than what we've had in the past, so that we're centering on the gene of interest and avoiding much of the deleterious plant material that in the past we've had to breed out through backcrossing and other segregation efforts. However, as we go along that regime, they are processes that are less familiar to the public. So the public isn't much concerned with traditional and mutagenic breeding because it's been around for a long time. And as a consequence, our regulatory structure really doesn't ask any questions about these. However, the public has lots of uncertainties about recombinant DNA techniques in this new genome editing technique, and therefore they have a lot of questions which may elevate regulatory focus on these types of products. So depending on the process, we get different types of analyses on identical products. So does the absence of regulatory concern, as I showed you earlier, for some of the more simple genome editing techniques that do not involve transgenic material, does that relate to an absence of public concern? Well, to address that, we have to ask a different question or a further question. What should be the basis of our regulatory processes? Do we regulate based on public perceptions or perceived risk? These are intrinsic concerns reflecting beliefs. So when someone in the public or maybe ourselves look at a new technology and feel discomforted from it, we say, you know, that doesn't seem natural. When that's a perception, and we don't want to regulate on that. Regulators and scientists would rather be looking at real risks, extrinsic concerns regarding whether the product we're developing is going to have human health or environmental safety concerns that we need to be concerned about. So our regulatory apparatus is geared towards evaluation of real risk, but the public keeps coming at us with their perceptions, and those perceptions have to be answered just as much as the real science issues have to be answered. And that's a hard pill to swallow for many of us scientists. So regulatory science is the activity that undertakes this responsibility of decision making at the confluence of science, regulation, and public understanding. It tries to work with the intermix of the science we have, the way we try to manage and communicate it, as well as our perceptions of risk as individuals and the public. And it also involves science that tries to improve the process for types of regulatory assessments and for understanding the trade-off between our science-based risk and uncertainties that are based on perceptions of risk. So what we need to do as scientists and regulators and product developers is make the unfamiliar become familiar. It's the only way we ultimately overcome public questioning of the technology. And in the case of genome-edited crops, I've listed a whole host of concerns that many scientists working in the area say, well, it's not that big of a deal for the crops and the products we're developing, but it is a big deal from the standpoint of the integrity of the process in the mind of the public and for having the public trust what we're doing as scientists. So targeting specificity, mismatched targets, downstream effects potentially from mismatches, these are all things that need to be evaluated just as much as the efficiency of our editing techniques and the ability to get the product that we want out the door. So common knowledge amongst experts like you does not translate to familiarity with the public. And one thing that we have to do as scientists is be willing to step out of the laboratory, step out of the field, and take time to integrate our knowledge, to synthesize our knowledge, so that we can better communicate to the public, particularly the engaged public, our knowledge of the plant breeding process and how modern biotechnology fits into that. I'm giving you here three good examples of where scientists have taken that time to explain things such as crop genome plasticity or the plant breeding process and how it allows us to select for beneficial characteristics while eliminating deleterious characteristics, or how we look at transgenic materials and evaluate them from the standpoint of their efficacy as well as their potential safety concerns. The public needs to know these. This is information that's widely held as general knowledge within our community, but it isn't always present in evidence-based information such as these publications, and we need to encourage this kind of work. So regulatory science has to continue to address these questions of safety and regulation, talking about optimized systems, validated systems for understanding off-targets, making sure that we are placing forward plant materials that do not have any of the genome editing machinery remaining in them. We also need to be concerned about the balance of governance and regulation. We as scientists can impose research governance models which involve communication efforts, transparency and communication, protocols for product development and evaluation that can be done as a collective scientific activity, and in doing so, build public trust and reduce burden on regulators. Because I said at the outset of this talk, we face a massive wave of innovation. We want these innovations to come forward in products that can be used by society, but our regulatory apparatus is not going to be able to handle this massive amount of work if there are a need to regulate in each and every instance these genome-edited crops. So in the area of regulatory and public policy, we need to understand regulators and publics seek assurances that we as scientists are asking the right questions and doing the right things. We have to address their questions, whether or not we think they're relevant to the science we do or not. And we need to continually focus in our outreach on the benefits of the technology, the emphasis on evaluating safety and behavior and performance of the phenotype, and not on the process itself. But in order to get to that place, we're going to have to spend some time communicating to the public and regulators what we understand about the process. So we're in a horse race for public acceptance. Science has really moved ahead rapidly in this field. We hear of new breakthroughs every day in the area of genome editing, and we're seeing just a host of applications following close behind. But public concern is out there, and I'm afraid that regulation is lagging behind. Despite all the good efforts by regulators in Europe and the United States, for example, and other countries to keep abreast of this changing technology, our regulators are being held back by regulatory science. It's got them pinned against the fences. It can't break free. We need to have improved regulatory science to allow the regulation to move forward. And at the end of the day, we want to finish 1, 2, 3, science, regulation, and applications. So the research community has an obligation to continue to talk about the benefits of the technology and to develop this technology, but we also have the need to anticipate significant engagement and investment to address questions by regulators and the public at large. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank my colleagues that I collaborate with at our Crop Bioengineering Center at Iowa State University, where we're concerned not only with developing technologies for genome editing of crops and identifying useful traits, but also understanding these issues of public policy and communication. Thank you.